Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. My guest for this episode is Bonnie Preston, and we talk about systemic change, how to take action within the current political and social environment in the United States to affect really the necessary change for the betterment of ourselves, our community, and the world around us. Our conversation is, by and large, U.S.-centric, but what we talk about, the methods and actions, apply readily to any nation, state, or local democratic government where the power of the system is explicitly and inherently within the will of the people. If you've got council members you can go talk to, if you've got elected representatives, you can use what we talk about. I came to have a knowledge of Bonnie and her work after my wife attended the Pennsylvania Women in Agriculture Network's Woman to Woman Conference. There, Bonnie gave a presentation. An activist, me, about the ways that we can change legislation through grassroots organizing and local ordinances, and shared it in a way that empowers the individual to really feel that you can do this and work towards making a difference. When my wife got back from the conference, Bonnie was the first person we talked about, and my wife was really passionate about everything that Bonnie had to share. Because of that, spirit of possibility, that ability for an individual to contribute, to make a difference. With my wife so enthused, I knew I had to talk with Bonnie. And in the end, I'm really glad I did. Our conversation flows really well with the narrative that begins with her bio, laying out how years before her birth, there was this multi-generational focus that set Bonnie down the road that would eventually lead to this work for change. And that forms our starting point, our seed, which then grows and blossoms as we move forward through time and receive various introductions to the people and organizations that impacted Bonnie's life and led to the actions that she took to bring about meaningful change in her community. And I don't know if you're familiar with Roger Swain. He was the man in the red suspenders who hosted the Victory Garden on public television in the United States. But he also was, I think he was the editor for Horticulture Magazine, wrote a number of gardening books. But I love his writing for exactly the same reason that I like this conversation with Bonnie. Both of them seem so casual and easygoing that I didn't realize at the time, through reading or talking, the wealth of knowledge being imparted on me until everything was said and done. And then, with Roger Swain, at least a few hours or days later, perhaps I'd have that aha moment. But with Bonnie, came within a few minutes with how to engage in a grassroots, bottom-up effort that really brings people in together in a way that they can act towards a common cause. If you like this interview with Bonnie and find value in it, please share it with others. Send a link to your friends or family. Post it to Facebook or Twitter, or whatever other ways you use to reach people in this wonderful, connected digital age. And I've got a few thoughts about this, but I'll save those until after the interview. Until then, I hope you enjoy this time with Bonnie Preston as much as I did. Could you give us a little bit of your background and how you got involved in activism and community change?
Yes. First, though, I'd like to say that I'm not by nature or profession an activist. So I feel like if I can do this, anybody can. It's sort of not something I ever thought I would get involved with. I'm a community college librarian, and I spent my career trying to teach students how to find, evaluate, and use effectively information. And that's still what I'm most comfortable with and try to spend most of my time doing. And I think my interest in the issues started probably long before I was born. My dad was a dairy farmer in Wisconsin. His father, my grandfather, was a friend of the La Follettes. And my dad remembers and tells stories of times when the La Follette would come to the farm and my grandfather would have known he was coming and gathered all of the surrounding farmers, and they would sit around the porch in the evening and talk politics. And my dad continued that. He wasn't really an activist, but he did continue that interest in politics. That was our dinner table conversations when I was a kid. And it was just a way of growing up that was where your idea that politics was important was really formed without my ever knowing it. I say my dad wasn't an activist, but he did know all of his congresspeople. He was active in his union. So those kinds of things just were a part of my life growing up. And then I started working, and I kept this interest in issues and interest in politics going without actually doing anything about it. And one of the reasons for that, I think, along with, well, I guess connected to being a librarian, I never wanted to be a scholar, as in going in depth and getting a PhD. I had a very wide range of issues I was interested in, but not a great deal of depth regarding those issues. And so it was like, okay, what am I going to be active in? Because there was just too much. It was just impossible. And then I read an article by Ronnie Duggar, who is a journalist and a Texas populist. And we always think these days about Texas oilmen, but in the 1880s, it was the Texas populists that were so important. And so Ronnie comes out of that tradition, and he wrote this article for The Nation magazine called something like, "Will the Real Populists Please Stand Up?" And talked about how corporations control everything in our country, and that all of the really big issues are blocked. Anything that people want to do about these issues is blocked because of the power that corporations have. So all of our environmental problems, we can't do anything about because corporations have too much power, and it just goes on and on and on, almost every issue you can think of. And I said, this is it. And he said at the end of the article, if we try to do something, we may fail, but if we don't try to do something, we've already failed. And I just got interested in that. I mean, I just really latched onto that issue because I am a big picture person, and that was the big picture that I'd been looking for, I guess. After the article appeared, Ronnie said he had never gotten more than 3 responses to anything he'd ever written before, but he got thousands of responses to this article. And so he decided that it was time to start a group, and he formed the Alliance for Democracy. And I became involved with that. And that was my first actual involvement with real activism. And I was part of a chapter in Baltimore where I lived at the time. And mostly we met and talked about things, but we also did some program planning. I remember had a speaker come and talk about single payer healthcare, which is another thing that we can't have single payer healthcare because of the insurance industry and the pharmaceutical industry and the AMA and all of these corporate aspects of things. So we did a few things like that, and I became a part of the National Council for the Alliance for Democracy. And then after I moved to Maine, I started what should be a chapter of the Alliance here on the Blue Hill Peninsula, but we haven't gotten enough active people yet to make that really effective. So I have an email list, and I communicate with people about the issues that the Alliance is working on. And I have continued to be involved in a variety of things. And along the way, the Alliance for Democracy became aware of a group that Thomas Lindsay started roughly the same time we were starting the Alliance for Democracy. And I don't remember the timeline of all of this, but the group that we got involved with is called the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, and it was founded by Thomas Lindsay. And he said when he first became a lawyer, and he was from central Pennsylvania, small town, and he put up his shingle and advertised himself as an environmental lawyer, and he started getting these calls from people, and they said, you know, we want you to help us keep this CAFO out of our town, or we want you to stop this corporation from putting a hard rock mining operation abutting our elementary school, or we don't want to allow people to spread sewage sludge on our fields, and just a whole lot of issues. And he said that when he went to court on all of this, he learned pretty quickly that you could slow down these kinds of things, but you couldn't stop them. And that was because our environmental regulations are set up to limit harm, but not to eliminate it. And that basically, and there's a long history to this that we don't need to go into, but basically over the years and decades, in fact, Supreme Court decisions have given corporations more and more power. And as long as they're doing something legal and you don't have zoning rules in place, you can't do this after the fact, you have to already have them in place, they can do what they want to where they want to do it. And of course, they're the ones who have, you know, legal staff and all the time and money in the world to get what they want. And a small town doesn't have either the money or the knowledge or the legal means of really stopping them. And so he had this great insight about the way that corporations use the legal system to get their way, and decided that he needed to figure out a way to get around that. So he came up with the idea of what he calls rights-based ordinances. And he goes back to the Declaration of Independence, which lays out just real basic human rights that all Americans have and that our country was at least theoretically founded upon. He looks at state constitutions, all of which have some phrase or sentence about how all power in name, it runs, all power is inherent in the people. In Pennsylvania, it starts out that way too, and goes on to say that the government is formed by the people and is there to support what the people want, and that the people have the right to change that government if they feel that they need to. And that's in virtually every state constitution, at least nearly. Most states also have home rule, which says that towns can pass ordinances governing what happens in their town. And so he combined these things and said that a town has the right to craft a local ordinance that denies the corporate right to do whatever it is they want to do in that town. And so he started using those rights-based ordinances to keep corporations from coming into a town and just overwhelming the town. You know, his kind of bottom line idea is that a corporation that is headquartered probably anywhere from hundreds to literally thousands of miles from the town that you live in shouldn't have more rights than you in terms of what is going to happen in that town, that the people who live in the town ought to be able to say whether or not what the corporation wants to do is acceptable to them. And of course, this just upends everything. Once you do that and say, no, corporations don't have these rights in our town, it's a whole new ballgame. So after doing this for a few years, he started what he called the Democracy School. Democracy School, the official name of it is the Daniel Pennock Democracy School. And Daniel Pennock was a young boy, I think he was about 14, and his school was on the far side of some fields that had been spread with sewage sludge, and he would walk across the fields to go to school, and he picked up toxins that killed him. And so Thomas named the school in his honor and memory. He has been doing these democracy schools around the country for some number of years now. People in the Alliance started going to democracy school and seeing that as a really good way to organize our work. One of our members, Ruth Kaplan, who was in Washington, D.C., got the idea that that would be a way to stop the corporations that are taking our water virtually for free, bottling it, reselling it back to us at an incredible rate of profit, and in the meantime, you know, destroying the environment and wreaking havoc in a lot of small towns, because most of the places where they get their water are small towns, although some of them are also just straight out of municipal water systems. One of them comes from a well that is right over a brownfield, and so it's been contaminated. So it's really crazy. This was a big issue for the Alliance, was trying to get this whole water privatization system stopped in a variety of ways. And so we started working specifically with CELDEF, first in New Hampshire and then in Maine, to stop water bottling. And the first town to pass an ordinance against bottled water was Barnstead, New Hampshire. Now some more towns in New Hampshire have passed the ordinance, and two towns in Maine have passed that ordinance. And the democracy school is something that just totally changes people's perspective on things. And it's really been a life changer for a lot of people in terms of their views of things, because traditionally we've tried to work within the regulatory structure. And he said, you really can't do that. And he shows why and how this whole system works in the democracy school. And so people know that it doesn't make any difference, really, to say we don't really want this. You need to put the force of law behind it. Home rule laws basically say that a local ordinance should be assumed to be in effect until a court overturns them. And what happens usually with these ordinances is that if a town passes a rights-based ordinance, the company just moves on. And so it does save that town. It also teaches people so much in the whole process of getting one of these ordinances passed, because you have to do a lot of organizing in your town. If you do work with CELDEF, they'll come to town and do a democracy school, talk with your select board. They'll also cover legal expenses. So it's a really terrific organizing tool to do the rights-based ordinances.
So combining the rights-based ordinances with the knowledge that comes out of the democracy school puts power in the hands of the local community in such a way that it becomes expensive to litigate for corporations, and that's one of the reasons that pushes them on, or?
It's not that expensive for corporations to litigate it, because if they do litigate it, one of the things that people find is that the courts just automatically say, yeah, this won't stand, because, and the phrase that everybody uses, they use it when people are trying to get these passed too, is that state law preempts local law and federal law preempts state law. So because of state and local laws, a local ordinance telling a corporation they can't operate in your town simply won't stand up in court. And that's generally what happens. But the corporations, by the time a town has gone through this whole process of the rights-based ordinance, they've generally gotten the message that they are not going to be welcome in that town, and they just don't want the hassle of even being there. And usually it's been easy enough for them to just move down the road to a town that doesn't object to them. And so that's generally what has happened. The expense of litigation has far more impact on the town and the townspeople than on the corporation, because they have all the money in the world. So that isn't really a concern for them. It's more of a public relations kind of thing. They generally just give it up. The two towns that passed rights-based ordinances against bottled water in Maine were Shapley and Newfield, and they're neighboring towns, and share an aquifer, which is also shared by a wildlife refuge area. And Nestle, which is the largest food company in the world, headquartered in Switzerland, Nestle had come in and put test wells into that aquifer, and the town fathers knew about it, but nobody in town knew anything about it until people walking in that area, which is common for people there. That's one of the places where everybody walks and hikes and that sort of thing. So when they saw these test wells, that was the first they knew that Nestle was interested in taking their water. And so then they started the process, and the Alliance got involved because, you know, we were doing that kind of work. But once the ordinance is passed in those two towns, Nestle just came and took up the test wells and went away. That's usually what happens.
Even though the basis for your action is within the community through legislative change and legal action, it's the public awareness that brings about the change?
Yeah, that's really a good way to put it, I think. And it's part of the purpose of the whole thing. Lindsay is trying to really educate people about the way the system works in this country and the power of corporations. And this is one way of doing it. So it's sort of like, you know, the fleas on the dog. The towns that have passed these are little fleas on the, you know, the corporations, and they just pester them and they make them miserable for a little while, but they're not going to really overcome that corporate power in and of themselves. But the more people understand how the system works and are willing to work against it, then ultimately we can make that fundamental change. When I went to democracy school in 2007, one of the things that Thomas said was that he was hoping that enough people would be radicalized in a state that they would change the state constitution to say that corporations don't have personhood and aren't entitled to the rights, the constitutional rights of persons. And then ultimately enough states would do that work that it could happen on a national level. And so he's working from really grassroots organizing upward, whereas a lot of other groups, including Alliance for Democracy, are working from the top down. Alliance for Democracy is kind of working both ways, but some groups are working totally from the top down. So there's a group called Move to Amend, which is actually a coalition of groups that's working to get a constitutional amendment to say that corporations aren't persons, money is not speech, and that will allow overturning Citizens United and a whole host of other things that would limit the power that corporations have over our lives. It's kind of a two-pronged attack, but Thomas is devoted to working from the bottom up, from the grassroots level, and really radicalizing people at the bottom. Alliance for Democracy got involved in the Shapley and Newfield fights on water, and then the local farmers, what I have been working on the most in the last 2 years has been our local farm ordinance. The local farmers picked up on that idea. They knew they had to make some changes just to save the farms, and so they've done what is essentially a rights-based ordinance, although it's not a FLDEF ordinance, and so they picked up on that, and we've been using that in Maine to change the conversation around small farming.
One of the ideas that I was introduced to a few months ago within the world of permaculture is the idea of the various forms of capital that we have available to us. And from where we've gone so far in this conversation, it sounds like the corporations have the financial capital. They're the ones who really have the money that we would need to fight against in order to make a lot of the changes because of how embedded they are in the political system currently. And I've heard it once before, and I don't remember where, I'll have to see if I can find this figure, that for every dollar spent by a corporation on lobbying is something like a 1,000 times return for them because of tax breaks or favorable treatment, or as we were talking here about the way that they're able to fight legislation and get things moved in their direction. It sounds like this work with the Democracy School, with the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, the work that you're doing with the Alliance for Democracy, that taps into our social capital and our ability to communicate with one another. That by raising awareness and organizing people together, that we create systems and structures that are harder to fight because you can't throw money at them to make them go away.
Right, right. That's a really good way to put it. That's very perceptive. The other thing about capital that I've remembered for a long time, David Corton is a person who, I think his first book was called something like When Corporations Ruled the World. So he's been involved for a long time in this anti-corporate fight, and he got started in it because he worked with corporations and started to understand all this stuff and switched sides. But he did an article one time that I read, and the essence of it was that the only actual wealth in the world are our natural resources. So healthy soil, clean water, fresh air, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, is real wealth. And he said the corporations are rapidly turning wealth into mere money. And in the end, that you can't eat money. A lot of people have pointed that out. That's not a quote from him, actually, but that's the bottom line. I mean, we can see it in all of these things that are going on these days, especially the global warming. I heard somebody on the radio just a few days ago. I think he was with Shell Oil, but it might have been a different company. But at any rate, he was talking about how much oil there is in the world and that we're just going to be able to, you know, we're not going to run out of oil for centuries. I'm going, oh, right. It's pretty amazing. They think that they can just do whatever they want to and it's all going to turn out all right, but they are destroying the real wealth of the planet. I think one of the really great things about the whole permaculture thing is that that's really oriented toward restoring real wealth and really healing the planet in that way and creating soil that will grow crops that will nurture us instead of kill us.
There's a story the author Charles Eisenstein told at a lecture that I was at, and he was at a conference as one of the members of a panel, and they were talking about, you know, how do you build resiliency, how do you build wealth? And if I'm remembering the story correctly, and I apologize to Charles if I'm getting this wrong, but the person who spoke before him, when they were talking about building wealth, they were talking about, you know, buying gold and precious metals and putting those away and all these other things. And they turned to Charles and asked if he felt that that was a good idea. And he's like, I don't know that I would do that, because that opens you up then that someone can just come and rob you and take that from you. And I think his description was a little bit more graphic than that. But I'm reminded of Robert Rodale's, I think it was his last book, Save Three Lives. And it's one thing that I keep coming back to within the permaculture ideal, is that as you build these food systems that don't look like fields of crops, you produce things that are resilient because they can't be stolen. They can't be taken away on foot. Someone maybe may come and burn your fields or your forest, but if they don't know what they're looking for, then it makes it more resilient. That we produce these systems that you can have your bank account seized, you can be sued by a company, but as I learned from people who are tax resisters and others, if you don't have anything for them to take, then you become more resilient to those tactics, and it becomes harder for the system to work against you when you're not as involved in the system. When I was doing some background reading for this interview, I was on the New England Alliance for Democracy's website, and there was a list of like 148 nonviolent actions you can take.
Oh, right, yes. I don't remember who put together that list, but...
And it was just the reference to Gene Sharp, and part of my moving forward and listening to the work of modern anarchists from the political side of things, not the people who are trying to bring about violent revolution, but the people who are looking at personal freedom and the libertarians and my friends on the left, my friends on the right, the people who are on the center. We have a lot more in common these days than I think that we give credit for when we look at the message that's being delivered.
I think that's very true. And I think one of the things that we've found to be so important with our work here in Maine around the local food issues is that it brings together the entire political spectrum in a way that almost nothing else does, because everybody eats. And most people are really concerned about what they eat and what they're feeding their children. And we have a quote on one of our handouts, and I'm not going to remember it exactly, I'm sure, but it was from a brief that was filed by the FDA in a legal case, and it said that nobody has the right to feed their children whatever food they want to. And it's like, you know, we said, wait a minute, you know, if we don't have the right to say, we believe this is the healthiest food we can eat, and therefore we want to eat this and feed our children this. That's crazy. That's totally crazy. And nobody that's concerned about the food system that we have these days could possibly accept a statement that they don't have the right to choose something other than what they can get at the supermarket. It really does just cut across the political spectrum. It's been great.
And I'm happy that there are so many ways that are available to us, the more that we realize as individuals that the power of government comes from the people, that if we resist that system in meaningful, nonviolent ways by divesting capital in companies that we don't agree with, as is happening right now with the 350.org and the work of Bill McKibben, growing our own food, choosing not to buy GMO products or other foods that we feel are not appropriate for ourselves and our families, rebuilding the local community. It's a hopeful, positive movement that brings people together in a way that doesn't focus on scarcity or rarity or fear.
Right, exactly. It's such an important way to organize around these issues, and it's just been great. It's really been great.
And you're finding that the more that you provide these kinds of organizing activities and action, that it brings your community together and you are able to bring about change. Even if you're not winning all the time, you're winning enough to continue to carry on and feel that this work is important and providing real opportunities?
I think so. And it's hard right now to put your finger on it. I mean, the local food movement and farmers markets and all that still is only about 3% of the actual food budget in the country, whereas Walmart is heading toward, I mean, they're assuming that in a few years they'll have 50% of the market in the country. But 3% of the market has got the big ag people scared. You know, they want it all. They really want it all. And they're not happy about what's going on. But it's gaining so much ground. I mean, right after the California vote that defeated the GMO labeling bill, which cost Monsanto and friends almost $47 million, a 30-state coalition announced that they're going to be working on both the state and national levels to get a labeling bill, and that's going to be a lot harder to fight. And people are just becoming more and more aware of the terrible power that corporations have over us. And so you have to fight against it. You just have to. And people are fighting against it. It's got the corporations scared. Not scared enough yet, but scared. We can win. I mean, these things can change. Another thing that the Alliance is working on, we're part of this Move to Amend coalition, looking to get a constitutional amendment against corporate personhood. That's a really big issue. And here in Blue Hill, we got a town resolution asking our state legislators to ask our national congressional delegation to support a constitutional amendment against corporate personhood. There are well over 20 towns in the state that have passed those resolutions. There are more towns working on them. They'll go to town meetings in the spring. But there's also a state legislator who intends to introduce the legislation at the state level. That may happen in January and be passed in January. So this is one more step, and it's something that anybody and everybody can work on. I mean, if people go to www.movetoamend.org, they've got everything they need right there to learn how to do this in their town. You know, the more that do, the more people are going to realize. People always say, oh, corporations just have too much power, and they have all this money to spend. And I keep reminding them that what they don't have is the vote. If we can get enough people voting, that social capital that you talked about, people do still have power in this country. And we have won battles, and we can do it again. We can do some pretty big things. It takes everybody to get involved to some extent. And, you know, not everybody has time to be really involved. I have time because I'm retired now. So not everybody's in that situation where they can devote a whole lot of time, but everybody can do something. And that's what it takes. And pick something that's meaningful in your community, in your state, and on a national level, and get involved in it. We have a group in Maine that's working very hard to get a single-payer healthcare system for Maine. And the assumption is that we can do what Canada did. They got single-payer kind of province by province, and after the first few got it and it was very popular, then they were able to put it in place for the whole country. And we feel like we can do that too. And so working locally, working in your towns with people you know, you can make progress on these things, and then it can go into place on a bigger scale. And we have huge problems in this country, but if everybody gets involved and does something, the Alliance for Democracy is always trying to say, do something that is systemic and that really attacks the system. And these rights-based ordinances are one of those things. But there are other things, too. And it depends a lot on the issue that you choose. So the single-payer healthcare issue, if we actually got that and people really found out that they could just go to the doctor and get taken care of and they didn't have to worry how much it was going to cost them, if it would bankrupt them or not, if they just got healthcare that they needed, they'd stop being so susceptible to these people that scream socialized medicine and the government's taking things over and blah, 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 blah. And that would be huge. That would be just huge. The corporations will scare us about everything that they can scare us about and try to convince us that the only way that anything can really operate is if you put it in the hands of private corporations. And that's just not true. And I think people realize it. I think that more and more they're seen as in a variety of ways, and are willing to try to make changes on the local level and to keep some of the worst of the things happening, you know, from happening. We've seen the privatization of our prison system. And, I mean, if you're making a profit off of keeping people in prison, where's the incentive to try to rehabilitate people, put them back into society, keep them out of prison in the first place? I mean, our whole immigration system or non-system has been a huge boon to these private prison corporations because they can pick up immigrants who, you know, are not documented and just throw them in prison. We never used to do that. And the prison corporations have pretty much convinced our Congress that that's the way to handle this, to throw these people in prison. And it wasn't that long ago that we didn't do that. We just took them back across the border. Now they're in prison, and these companies are making a ton of money off of keeping people who haven't ever done anything wrong in prison. So it's just crazy.
I can speak from personal experience, having known some people who have served time in jail and prison. And it was very strange to see, after a friend of mine served several years, the person who they were when they came out, and the struggle that they had to become the person who they were before they went in. And I've studied sociology and recidivism rates and all of these other things, but it was only hearing those firsthand accounts of how that environment can make someone more likely to become an offender when they get out because of the system that they're put in and the things that they learn while they're there, that buck the system that exists in ways that are illegal. It was a very eye-opening experience to have some of those conversations. There's a book that I don't know if you've ever encountered, but it's No More Prisons by William Upski Wimsatt.
I haven't seen that.
Okay. He was a graffiti artist and a hip-hop kind of person who wrote a couple of books that talk about kind of social progress and keeping people out of prison and doing expressive art and some other things. And that was a very interesting read for me. A conversation I've been having in my communities, I'm white, middle class, relatively educated, privileged, and things. And it's only been in the last couple of months that I've come to understand the position that privilege puts me in. And that's been a very strange transition for me now to go back into the community and have conversations with people and begin to really understand the place where other people come from.
Right, which is so important. That there's another book out about prisons called The New Jim Crow, and it looks at the racist basis of current laws and everything around prison. That's a real eye-opener, too. After the Civil War, the southern states in particular, but not exclusively, tended to make the kinds of crimes that the freed slaves might be involved in felonies, and white-collar crime and other things were not. So we've just moved from keeping people enslaved and then keeping them repressed through the old Jim Crow laws after the Civil Rights Movement, 60s, 70s, and the former slaves in the country got the right to vote and got their civil rights recognized. Then they came up with ways to put them in prison. You know, our drug laws are intended for that, and it's just been devastating. It's really been devastating for Black community.
For someone who wants to bring about change, you've touched on this in various ways throughout our conversation, but to tie everything together, if someone wants to take up an issue and make a difference on it, to take action in the way that they're able, what are some steps that you would recommend for someone who wants to get involved?
I think probably the most important thing is for them to think about the issues that they're really passionate about, because you have to really deeply care if you're going to take the steps that are needed to really take action on things. And one of the ways that you can come up with a particular issue is to look at what's happening in your community. That's what we've done here on the Blue Hill Peninsula around the farming issue. I had been concerned about agribusiness for a long, long time. One of the leaders against corporate farm practices was also an Alliance National Council member. And he was such an inspiration and taught me so much about the pernicious systems that are in place regarding agriculture. And I knew that, but he really brought it into focus. And then when the opportunity came to do something about it in my community, and that's what I've been doing for 2 years now. I can't seem to stop. I mean, it's just something that's so important and so critical. And it's another one of those things that is real systemic change. If we can get rid of corporate agriculture, or at least put it in its place and change it to the point where people control our food system, it's going to be a real game changer for everything that's going on. So I think that, again, part of it really is just kind of finding your issue. And then the other thing that you have to do is to believe that you can make a difference. And so part of that is to find people in your community, or go online and find national groups, to find people who are actually working on this, and to find that when people get together and act, they can make a difference. They really can. So many people give up before they ever start. And there's this whole, you know, you can't fight City Hall and that kind of attitude. And a lot of people just don't believe that they could possibly have any effect. I've been involved with the Maine Fair Trade campaign. Global trade was the first big issue that the Alliance worked on. And so been involved with that for a long time. And we had a meeting just yesterday, and we had a conversation with the head of the Citizen Trade Campaign, which is the national organization that we're affiliated with. And he just went through the list of the big fights on trade that we have won. And it was very inspiring. We really needed to hear that. So you do need to believe that you can make a difference. And then just find your way in and find what you're comfortable with. I mean, I hate making phone calls, but I'm happy to do other things for a group. And if I had to spend all my time just calling people and giving this little canned speech that they always give people to do, I couldn't do that. So find something that you can do and then work in that way. And everybody can do something. You know, I like to write letters to the editor. everybody reads letters to the editor. If they get a newspaper at all, they read the letters to the editor. That's just a given. And you can really make a dent. You can also, through that, you can form relationships with the people who are publishing your paper. So, especially in smaller towns, the newspapers are still really critical parts of your community. And so you can work in that way. Contact your legislatures. And again, it's really incredible in Maine. I mean, you have very easy access on both the state and national levels to our legislators. And so talk with them and form relationships with them and make sure that they know what you're interested in. I have a good relationship with my congressman and was able to get him to come last year and meet with the farmers in this area. And it was really terrific. He came, he visited Quill's End Farm, where Heather and Phil Rettberg are the kind of the leaders in this movement in this area. And then we had some of the core group of people that are working on this come over, and we sat around their kitchen table for a while. We have a photograph of our congressman pouring himself a big glass of raw milk. And he said, oh, I love raw milk. I grew up on raw milk. You know, we got it from my neighbor. And we're saying, yeah, and we want to be able to still do that. And then we had a big potluck at the Grange, and there were, I don't know how many people were there. I don't know the actual count, but the room was over half full, and people were thrilled. A lot of those people had never met our legislator before, our congressman. And they did, and they were really, really happy that he took the time and came out and talked to them and spent time with them around this issue. And so you can do things like that. So there's just, you know, you just have to find what it is you can do and get involved in that way. And everybody can do something. That's, I guess, the bottom line. So.
Is there anything else that you would like to add to this conversation for the listeners after everything that we've covered? Any final thoughts or anything?
No, I wish I, you know, had a brilliant quote for you, but I don't, I do. You know, I just want to really encourage people to get involved and never give up. There's a good quote. Rachel Carson, I think it was, who said when she was asked to what she attributed her success, she just said persistence. And one of the things that we find is that people can get all excited about something and start to get, you know, get involved and be involved for a little while. And then if they don't see an instantaneous result, they just quit. And you just can't do that. You just have to keep at it.
I'm relearning that lesson all the time because I have two small children. And just the other day, my daughter was trying to juggle two balloons at the same time and toss one up in the air and then toss the other one up so she could catch it. And she just couldn't do it. And she would try twice and then scream and stamp her feet and run away. And it's like, honey, let's break this down. Let's just do one balloon. And she does that for a couple of times and drops it and gets angry. It's like, well, honey, you have to keep trying. You can't do two balloons until you can do one.
Right. There you go.
That same process as adults, I feel like we've reached that point where it's, well, if I can't do it right the first time, I'm just not going to do it. But how did we learn to walk? How did we learn to talk or tie our shoes or write our names? We did it over and over and over again.
Right. Yep. And we fell down along the way and messed up along the way and all of those things, but you just keep going.
And I can point my listeners to this show. If you go back and listen to some of that early material 2 years ago, oof, it was rough. But it keeps getting better. So I found my strength is in calling people, because this would be an awkward interview if it was in person. But yeah, if you don't think you can do this, somebody, if you're a listener to the show, listen to those first episodes, realize how much I screwed up, and then listen to a great interview with Bonnie like we're having today, and you'll realize, if I can do this, you can make some change in the world. But thank you so much for this time, Bonnie. This was great, and I'm so happy that my wife got to meet you and let me know about the work that you're doing so that we could have this conversation. There's so much here for people to take away from it.
Well, I hope so. Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity.
I will certainly keep looking at the work that you're doing and let people know more as you and your organizations continue this great work.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that is our time with Bonnie Preston. What keeps coming to mind, my aha moment from this, as I apply the systems thinking that comes from permaculture along with the principles, is finding a local issue and how we can use that as a leverage point to connect our community, to bring in these disparate groups of people who, on paper, may not have that many connections, if any at all. But as we get down to it, we find something that is emotional enough or big enough to really get them together. Something that's going to be the right size to allow us to engage but not be overwhelmed. And thankfully, with these ideas of rights-based ordinances and local action, we can take the fight for appropriate change to the very local level, in individual towns and cities to make a difference, where the people to talk to number in the hundreds or perhaps thousands, not the tens of thousands. If we apply the zone model from permaculture to this thought, you might be looking at community zones, if you will, one or two, places where we have a lot of influence. And then as we begin to change them, we can look at how to use that as a model. Look for the patterns in these small community zones and apply them as we look forward to zone 3, and we can begin to dream about zone 4. What did you think about this time with Bonnie Preston and the information that she shared? Can you take what she gave to us and make a difference in your local community? Or are you already sending a message to the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund to organize a democracy school in your own area? If you are inspired by this, if you have found something within it that allows you to take action, use your voice, whether that is your spoken word or connections with friends, a dinner conversation, or a note sent to someone, be it handwritten or electronic. But share your change, your message with others. Let them know about the difference that this conversation with Bonnie makes in your life. Take the inspiration that you find and share it with others so that they might find their own inspiration and their own role to do something. As the Permaculture Directive reminds us, we can help others to take responsibility for their own lives and those of their descendants. And while you're helping others, let me know about your thoughts, actions, and activities in this world of ours, what you're doing to help design and build a better world. As I share this with you, your stories provide me and many others with inspiration. Email me, show@thepermaculturepodcast.com, or give me a call, 717-827-6266, or you can leave a comment on the website at thepermaculturepodcast.com. While you're there, as we close out the year, consider making a gift to support the show. With your help, we've reached 1,000 listeners and are in line to keep on growing. Together, we can keep the show going and reach another 1,000 or 2 or 3 or maybe even more in 2013. And with that new year fast approaching, there's only one episode left of the Permaculture Podcast. And that's an interview with Eric Tonesmeyer, and we'll be discussing financial permaculture and the upcoming financial permaculture workshop that will be held from January 21st through the 25th, 2013, in Homestead, Florida, which is, I believe, just south of Miami, at Earth Learning. Eric's enthusiasm with this upcoming conference and the information being provided left me without words a few times during our conversation, and I'm glad that he was able to jump in and pick up. I'll blame it on being sick and a little slow lately, but man, there was a lot of good information in this, and it was just amazingly overwhelming in a perfectly good way. And you can expect that show on December 28th, 2012. Before we lead into another short break for the new year, and the show should return January 4th, 2013. Until that next time, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other.